Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome back to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I shine a spotlight on the incredible women working in the film industry today. In today's episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by Ivana Primorac, a highly acclaimed makeup and hair designer whose work has brought characters to life in films like Atonement, Billy Elliot, The Reader, and most recently, Barbie, Lee, and We Live in Time. In today's conversation, we'll be diving into her creative process, career highlights, and the artistry behind her craft. I hope you love today's episode, and thank you for listening. I hope so. I hope so. Fingers crossed. Technology is just not being our friend today. I'm glad we finally found a moment to chat anyway, and I'm really excited to speak with you, and thank you for taking some time out to speak with me on my podcast out of what I imagine is probably quite a busy schedule. I mean, I can't imagine you've got a quiet schedule. I mean, maybe at this time of year, I don't know, is it starting to quieten down for you, or is it like jigging up for the new year?
It's getting busier because we had a very, very quiet year this year. I think everyone universally has had a bit of a clunky year, but it feels like now it's going to get really ramping up. And I think lots of people's financing wasn't really in place after the strike. So it feels like we're ramping up to a really busy year next year, a lot of stuff, yeah.
Okay, that's exciting. Yeah, a lot of things were sort of put on pause during the, was it the SAG AFTRA, you know, I was going to say Astra, no, it's a film, SAG-AFTRA strike. So yeah, I mean, I heard that from other podcast guests that they were saying that a lot of things had just come to a halt, really. But hopefully, I mean, it seemed to be a positive outcome from the strike. So yeah, hopefully it's good.
You know, it's really difficult to figure out if it's been positive or not, because so many people have been really in a difficult situation. And, you know, certainly in the States as well, the industry is kind of halted almost. So it's difficult to know. And I hope they don't have to renew all of this again with AI and all the stuff. They say they have to renegotiate every 3 years. And you think, oh, no, we can't go through another strike.
Can't have that every 3 years. It'd be like, stop, start, stop, start. Especially for an industry that's literally thrives on being like fast paced and things coming out at a fast rate. Yeah, it's not so good when things stop. And where are you currently based? Are you in London or in Croatia? Or
I'm in London. Okay. And I'll have Christmas in Croatia and in Berlin, and then
lovely,
back to London and going back to work.
Yeah, so from like January you'll be like straight back to work, basically.
Straight back to work and pretty much solidly till the end of the year, I think.
Wow, so you probably won't see the holidays, like it'll just like go by in a flash, so you'll have to enjoy it.
But I'm ready now. I'm ready to go back.
So oh yeah, that's good. But yeah, I mean, reading about your career and everything has been so interesting. You've got like a really enviable CV. You know, you've worked on so many major projects, from Atonement to Billy Elliot, and like more recently now, you know, Barbie and We Live in Time, and also Lee, and you've got BAFTA nominations. So like, yeah, you've done so much. But before like I dig into that side of things, yeah, I'd love to sort of rewind back to the beginning of your career and, you know, what you were like as a child and a teenager growing up in Croatia, about your studies were and your hobbies, and, you know, if, you know, becoming a makeup artist was something that was quite obvious early on.
What a good question. Well, I growing up in Croatia, it was then Yugoslavia, so it was a very different country, and it was a great place to live, but it was kind of, you know, it was a socialist country, so the opportunities for employment were not really the same as they are now. And I come from a very academic family, and they're all lawyers and judges, and my sister is into languages and literature. Mm-hmm. And she knew exactly what she wanted to do at the right time of in her life, and I didn't. And it was a bit tough because I just didn't know how to deal with that. And if I had an opportunity to possibly have a year out, maybe, you know, do something and do a job.
Yeah, like a gap year.
Yeah, exactly. You know, work in a bar or something, or in a shop or whatever. God knows what would have happened. But I was really desperately trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And now thinking back to those times, I'm so lucky that I did choose a brilliant career for myself, because it could have all been a wrong thing for me. But basically, I loved film. My parents always took us to the cinema a lot, and I watched a lot of films. And in thinking about what my career path might be, I thought, well, I'm going to have to study something for a year because I'm too young to do anything else, and I couldn't really get a job. So I started studying law. Mm-hmm. And that was just because it was the first year of law is very general. It's just, you know, history of law, and it's quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I passed a few exams and I thought, I can't see myself doing this. This is definitely not for me. And what am I going to do? And at that time, somehow, I watched a lot of Dustin Hoffman movies that kind of culminated with Tootsie. And I thought, who does that? I mean, that's an amazing thing to do. And then I watched Amadeus, and that Milos Forman's film called Amadeus. Mm-hmm. And the character Salieri was brilliantly aged by Dick Smith. And that was one of the best makeups I've ever seen in my life. And I thought, how is this possible that this character, this actor, is not this old and it looks so amazing? And I thought, I would quite like to do this job. And then the big kind of how do you go about this? And I somehow, I don't even know how, I managed to find out that the BBC in London had a training course. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, if they accept you in, you did 5 years of training with them, and then you kind of move through the ranks. And I thought, this is just the best thing I've ever heard. So I somehow persuaded my parents to let me go to London and see if I could somehow get into the BBC and into the training
program. And what age were you at that point?
I was 18.
Oh, wow. That's quite young.
So I was quite young, and I thought, well, let's see if I can. So I arrived in London, and I luckily had an English teacher from Zagreb, from Croatia, was from London, and she had a little shop in London, and she had a house in London where I could. So I worked in her shop and subletted the room from her, and met sort of a bunch of students and my first friends in London. And I sort of slowly started to find out what you need to do to apply for the BBC for this training course. Mm-hmm. And I realized that you have to first do some sort of a course, and then there's 3 months of interviews, and there's about 4,000 people that apply for this for six jobs, basically.
Yeah, I think BBC's always been the same. It's a very competitive, whatever you apply for at the BBC, I feel. But yeah.
But it was the golden, it was kind of the end of the BBC as we know it now, but it was a golden age. I mean, they were making comedy, they were making period dramas, they were making, you know, everyone watched period dramas and comedy programs, mm-hmm. and everything, and people, you know, makeup artists did the news, did, you know, you did everything. And I just thought, this is just the best thing I could think of. So the course that I found that I wanted to do was £1,000. And my parents were like, well, we can't pay that. The equivalent course now is about £23,000.
I was going to say, yeah, like at the time, that, I mean, now that doesn't seem like a lot, but at the time.
There's nothing, yeah. So it's something like equivalent of 20,000 today. And and they were like, we just can't pay that. And I thought, well, I can't go home till I've given it a proper go. So I thought, I know what I'll do is I'll work. So I did. I started work, and I also started having a great time. And, you know, it takes a lot of money to live in London.
Go out. Like it always has.
But I was like, this is not going to happen. So I decided to go to America, and I was a nanny for a year because I just wanted to make sure all the money that I earned, and I couldn't really go out when you're a nanny because you can't really.
Well, no, you're looking after kids.
Exactly. So I thought, this is going to be definitely a way I can save money. So I did that. So I went off to Washington, D.C. and worked with this amazing family that I still keep in touch with. And I saved all my money. And then I came back to London. So now it's like 2 years have gone by. So now 20. So by the time I got back to London and did my course and everything, it was 21. And then that time I started my BBC. I got a job in Screenface, which was it was the best makeup shop in London.
Okay, Screenface.
And so I was in kind of within, you know, the industry and makeup artist, and it was owned by Magdalene Gaffney, who was amazing, a makeup artist, and her husband, and she used to work at the BBC, and she was freelance by then. So I was at least mingling around, you know.
Definitely.
People were coming in and talking about projects they were doing and everything, and so that was quite exciting. And then I did my 3 months of interviews, and I had a letter from the BBC saying, you're very, very happy to say that you got in.
Amazing.
And I was like, oh my God, this is like the best thing ever. And then the next day, I had a phone call from Eileen Mayer, who was the head of BBC makeup department branch thing. And she said, we're really sorry, we made a mistake. Oh. It's not you. We sent the wrong letter to you.
Oh my God, that's so embarrassing for them as well to. Oh, but like,
you know, and she used to come to Screenface a lot as well, and she recognized me, and she was always so sweet, and she was always so apologetic. And And it was kind of thing like, I think you could sue them probably for, you know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, once they've sent something, it's kind of too late. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've already, it's official.
Said, you know, you confirmed it's me, so you're going to have to take me or whatever. But at the time, it was like, I was like, oh, no.
Oh.
But that was luckily, you know, by then, with all my experience and the course and everything, I was kind of, I was more mature. By then, I was 21.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'm just going to have to do what BBC was going to do for me, do by myself. I don't know how I'm going to do that. But also, BBC closed their doors a year later. There was no more makeup department. There was nothing. And they stopped the training program.
Oh, no. So, the timing and everything.
So it wouldn't have worked for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I luckily, by figuring out that that is how I wanted to start my career, and because what we do really is an apprenticeship, I just thought, I'm just going to do the same. So I wrote to loads of people, I mean, as many people as I possibly could. And Naomi Dawn, who is an amazing makeup artist, makeup designer, answered my letter and asked me to come and work as a trainee on Great Balls of Fire, which was a young Winona Ryder. I think she was 13 at the time.
Wow.
And Dennis Quaid, you know, doing a movie here in London in Hammersmith Odeon, I think. And so there was like thousands of background, and, you know, and that's how I met Naomi, and we're still friends and we still collaborate and speak quite often. And it's kind of an amazing friendship that, you know, she was the first person who
got you your first job, really.
Yeah. And then I met a few more people and everything. And then eventually I became Jenny Sherko's assistant for very many years, and I still think she's the best in the industry and does most impressive films, and I always think of her makeups and her films as the best. I still look up to her. So yeah, so that was my path very earlier on. But I'm very glad that, you know, throughout the whole thing, that I did really want to do it, and that I obviously somehow was receptive to learning, because you just never know if you're going to be any good.
Not until you try.
Exactly. And so that was very lucky, and I'm just really grateful that somehow I managed to find something that I was really into, and I think I'm still into it as much today as I was
as then. You were then. I mean, you mentioned Naomi there and a few other people, but did you have anyone that was like a key mentor that really like helped you keep going and gave you that kind of confidence in yourself and your ability in the early days?
Jan Sewell I work with, but I would single out Naomi and Jenny Sherko definitely, because I work with them the most and I look up to them a lot. Yeah. And it was a kind of quite recently, I did a television series called Pistol with Danny Boyle. And we were filming in the 100 Club, which is on Oxford Street, and it's still owned by the same family. And the Pistols actually started there in 1975. This is where one of their first gigs was.
As in the Sex Pistols?
Sex Pistols,
right,
yeah.
Okay, I thought you said the Pistols. I was like, what? I don't know that band, but yeah.
Yeah, the Sex Pistols, yeah. Okay. And I worked in the 100 Club before I worked at Screenface as the barmaid.
Oh.
And the same family still own the club. And
such a full circle moment.
And we were filming a scene that from the television scene as a series that recreated the Sex Pistols gig at the 100 Club. And so suddenly I walked in and there it was. There it was, exactly the same club, exactly the bar was the same. I knew where all the bottles were. The spirits were different because they were a bit modern. But everything else was exactly the same. And there was a journalist from New York Times that came to do an interview with all of us HODs, and she was talking to me. And I said, well, the strangest thing in the world is that I worked here. And I remember very, very clearly standing behind that bar going, all I want to do is one day become a makeup artist. And I remember thinking how desperate I was to actually do that job and make it, and suddenly I'm standing here in the same place.
It's fascinating.
It's fascinating, and I'm overwhelmed by this experience, and
it feels like a small world but such a big world, because you've come so far since, you know, obviously being a barmaid that back then, and then now filming there. So yeah, it's funny how things come back into your life.
But I was desperate to have, so yeah. You know, so that was kind of a cute moment there. Yeah.
Did you have like, on your sort of early projects working on that film with Winona Ryder, did they have like a lasting imprint on your approach to how you work still today, things you were taught and things you learned then?
Definitely. I think I was lucky that the people I work with are kind of incredibly accomplished and very, very good makeup artists who did a lot of period stuff. Mm-hmm. So I learned to work on characters from the best in the industry and how to actually tell the story by making people into different characters. Mm-hmm. And I think Jenny Shirko was definitely a person who always, we never did really modern day films. I think we mostly did very complicated character-based films. And I did, I think I learned everything from them in those early days, and I still have a very similar approach. Mm-hmm. I think things have changed a little bit these days with streaming and episodic television. And that sort of, you know, I think I've learned different skill sets on The Crown because mm-hmm. I've never done anything like it to that in that scale. I don't think anyone had at that point. Mm-hmm. And I really do think that I kind of made up an approach how to do those big films and retain the quality. And so that was something that I've learned definitely more recently, because that didn't exist when I first started. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different ball game, you know, how you actually staff it and how you quality control a show like that, how you actually budget it and how you put it together. So that was kind of a groundbreaking experience. Mm-hmm. The Crown was definitely that for me. But as far as techniques and characterization and how you approach a script, mm-hmm. that I learned definitely for those people very earlier on.
Mm-hmm. And it sort of continued, you know, like that throughout your career. I was wondering if there was any specific challenges that you faced when you were entering into the industry as a woman, or, you know, did you feel like a woman in a sort of a pond of a lot of men working in the makeup industry, or was there a lot of women also starting out similar to you?
It's a very good question. Recently, I worked a lot with Lindy Hemming as well, who is an amazing Oscar-winning costume designer. And she is Jenny Shirko's, you know, they're the same age and they mm-hmm. achieved kind of amazing things in the industry pretty much at the same time. And I worked with Lindy, with Jenny, on a film called System of Sister many, many years ago. And so I've known Lindy from then, and I also did Wonka with her recently. And we spoke about this recently, but Jenny for sure was very strict, incredibly strict as a boss. And she wanted to be taken seriously. And Lindy also says that they are the generation of women within the industry that were not necessarily taken seriously, but they were the first ones who kind of paved the way of trying to prove that they are as good as the men, mm-hmm. and they have a voice and they can do their job better than anyone else. But it's to be heard and respected was kind of, you know, they were the first generation, maybe not the first, but that was the time when that was very seriously not so, you know, within the industry. They wanted to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And they, by being so strict in how they ran their departments and how they spoke and how they behaved and how they dressed, was very much what they had to do to be taken seriously. So that fight was already happening before I joined. And being in those kind of departments, I was kind of learning and being with people who were, you know, fighting the battle, and we were already then, you know, more respected. Mm-hmm. So I never really had any challenging time in that respect. But I do remember thinking, my God, these are, you know, it's a very serious business being in the film industry. There was nothing frivolous about it. Mm. I've never had any kind of time where I could kind of behave badly or not turn up, or all those things were very, very clear from the beginning that you're not going to make it unless you take this completely, really seriously. This is not a joke. There's many people depending on you. Mm. You have to be prepared. So I learned kind of with those women, you know, fighting that fight, which I didn't understand at the time, that they were of generation who were not taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. At the BBC, you know, there's many stories you hear. You know, there was a time where people were drinking in bars, and, you know, at the BBC, there was a lot of kind of behavior that you wouldn't think that it would be allowed in a place of health and safety, and so much responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so women were not always taken seriously in those situations. There was a lot of, you know, after hours drinking and partying and stuff like that. So they come from a generation of women who had to, you know, change that.
Yeah.
By the time I joined, I was just there in their departments. And I could see how well respected they were. So I knew I wasn't going to stay unless I was I was also, you know, representing the department in mm-hmm. the way that they wanted me to.
Yeah. Obviously, typically, maybe now, you know, with influencers and YouTubers, a lot of girls do go into makeup for the beauty side of things. And what was it about, you know, the film side of things that really interested you more than, I suppose, to going into, say, beauty or fashion makeup? What interested you about maybe this sort of side that maybe doesn't seem so glamorous, like wigs and making wrinkles and fake blood and all that kind of thing? What was it about that that sort of appealed to you?
Well, what appealed to me was changing a person into someone else. That was what I...
Transformation.
Makeup for. It was a total transformation. And you know, if you take any actor who could then play anyone else, and you have to achieve the likeness, but also make them look good rather than, you know, a caricature. So the whole approach to that was what really interests me. And I luckily got in with people who assisted people who did those films still to the best quality. I mean, Jenny Sherka won an Academy Award for Elizabeth, and I still, first Elizabeth with Cate Blanchett, mm-hmm. and I still think that's probably one of the best makeup and hair movies ever made. I mean, it was sort of incredible. And being with her for those 3.5 months before we started shooting and the prep and everything was kind of extraordinary, to be part of all those meetings and learn from her. And, you know, and that is, you know, that was an incredible transformation.
Do you have
Cate Blanchett into the queen?
I know, I mean, some actors are unrecognisable, you know, when they've had their makeup done. I can think of one, was it Monster with Charlize Theron, where she's, obviously, I think she put on weight as well and different things, but mostly makeup and hair. Or like a different sort of category, but like the Grinch, like yeah. Jim Carrey. I'm always fascinated when I read about that and how he was like in the makeup chair for, I don't know, up to like 6-8 hours, I don't know, a day to do like that full
yeah.
look.
Yeah. So yeah. Monster is definitely one of my favourite. It's a great example of that. It's definitely one of my, so simple, you know, it was just a bit
yeah,
of makeup.
Yeah, it's very, it's subtle.
And it's incredible. And mm-hmm. there she was, this incredible, you know, she looked
totally different person.
Yeah.
I know, when you see her all glammed up, you're like, how is that? That's the same person. It's crazy. I'm wondering more now about the what the beginning to the end of a project looks like for you. So from the moment that you agree to working on a film or a TV show, when you get the script in your hands and you're doing all that research, and then to being on set, how does that, I'm sure obviously it's different for every project, but yeah, how does it all kind of typically unfold?
Well, I'm really lucky that I kind of work with the same directors again and again and again. And I do work with a lot of actors again and again and again. But I would say my career sort of started being asked back by a few directors that I really admire and love work to work with. So when I usually get asked and read the script, I would then, the first thing is to talk to the director and just to find out what their vision is and mm-hmm. what they have in mind. Someone like Joe Wright is incredibly visual, and he would have already had most of the references, and he's very, very clear about what he wants to do. And mm-hmm. then my process with someone like Joe Wright would be to kind of get more references and more ideas that would just add to what he would already have in mind. And that was always incredibly rewarding, to find something that would be kind of not better, but kind of enrich his idea mm-hmm. of what the character would be, because he's so visual that he would respond very, very clearly. Someone like Stephen Daldry would never have an idea what he wanted a character to look like, but he would know what's right, what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So then my research for him would be very different. Then I would kind of pull out more different type of mood boards and different type of research material, and I would read as much as I can. And it used to be libraries, and I still have physical books. I usually buy physical books for every project that I kind of read through and look for different inspiration. Anthony Minghella was also quite visual, but he worked with Anne Roth, an amazing costume designer who is now 93 and still working.
Wow, that's impressive.
And I kind of, through working with her, I kind of liked becoming a member of the costume department almost. Like, I just want to be so close to them, their department, because they do the rest of the body.
Yeah, it's very, very close, the makeup, hair and the costume.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of love being as close to the costume department as possible. And that I learned through working with Anne Roth particularly. And I've never stopped doing that. And nowadays I work closely with Jacqueline Ran, and, you know, we've done lots of things together, and Lindy Hemming. And I just carry on in the same way, and it always works for the best. But I kind of then take some of their ideas and their thoughts further, and then pass on my ideas back to them and see where we get to. And by the time we get to see the actors and do fittings, we already have a plan what we would like each character to look like.
A lot of planning.
Yeah, there's a lot of planning. And then, of course, there's the script work that you have to figure out where they're going and where they've been.
Yeah, and logistics and, of things, you know.
Yeah, and it, what's fun is to give the viewer information about the character that is not on the page. You know, something about their background or something about their future or something about their, you know, how they are in their spiritual world rather than just on the exterior world. And you can do a lot of that with makeup. You can do a lot of that with how they made up and how their hair is, and facial hair certainly, and prosthetics as well. So that's kind of how I do it. I kind of try and tell the story in detail as much as possible.
Are you looking back at a lot of other films as well, like old films, makeup artistry from really old period films, like how they did it back then? Are you looking at that a lot?
Yeah, a lot. And it's interesting because working with Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach recently, they show films every Sunday that inspired them for that particular project. So
every Sunday, cinema, like
every Sunday morning, they'll show a film to the all their HODs. And so
when you say HOD, sorry, that's a new abbreviation for me.
Sorry.
Head of department. Okay, I did know it. I just wanted to check. Okay.
Yeah. So everyone who's kind of relevant creatively on that film, and in fact, they invite everyone who wants to come, but usually it's the creatives of the film. And we all meet on Sunday mornings in some cinema in London and watch a movie that they find relevant for that.
That sounds so fun.
And that is just the best fun you can imagine. And I've seen some films with them that I never knew about, and, you know, and you kind of don't, you can't even imagine why they would be relevant. And then you watch them and you go, oh my God, that's so amazing that it's so relevant.
And it's good to do that collectively as well. So you're all sort of, you can all maybe discuss it afterwards or.
Yeah.
I'm wondering also how you sort of balance staying true to some historical periods while maintaining your own artistic expression. Maybe, for example, in like Atonement or The Hours. I actually only watched The Hours for the first time this year, even though it came out ages ago. And again, another person. Yeah, how long ago?
24 years.
Oh my God. I mean, yes. I was going to say it's, yeah, younger than me slightly. I'm 29, but anyway. But also, that's another person that looks totally different is Nicole Kidman with the nose. I was like, she's a completely different person. But yeah, how do you sort of, did you get my question? Maybe I went a bit too fast, but yeah.
I did. Right, cool. I mean, Jenny Shirker was kind of a period purist. You know, she comes from a lot of research and the knowledge. Peter Owen, who I work with a lot as well, his company make all the wigs that I only work with him and his company because I just love the way they make wigs. He learned to make wigs by himself. He taught himself because the way the wigs were made traditionally, what kind of didn't make sense. They were not as realistic as he wanted them to be. So he started making wigs by reading lots and lots of, you know, different journals, and he kind of learned. And, you know, when you do certain periods and stuff, he knows exactly how they dress their hair. And so he tries to mimic that, and it always comes out looking exactly how they did. If you look at the paintings, he knows how to translate the what you see in the paintings to real life. And I come from working with people like that. So I definitely learned to want to be as close to the period, because it also then looks best. If you don't do it the way they would have done it, it doesn't look as good. So there's another reason to it. But then I also learned that you have to adapt the period to the face. Otherwise, it's not going to look as good. And Atonement is a very, very good example, because the people in question who Keira Knightley's kind of character would have belonged to, the kind of posher people in 1930s, late 30s, early 40s, looked much older because of the tight hairstyles, and they were not very glamorous. I think the American movies of the same period were very glamorous, and that's a kind of a different thing almost. But the reality, especially of European and British, the way British people looked at that time, even aristocracy, they didn't look very glamorous, because the nature of the hair was very tight and frizzy and short, and, you know, a lot of people don't really look great. So we started with Kira's character, we started doing it the exact traditional way, and she just looked much older and the hair doesn't move. And so I had to kind of find the way to do, I've learned how to dress the hair, how to cut the hair the way they did it. I remember buying amazing lot of books about how that process was at the time, and I remember cutting James McAvoy's hair exactly how they would have done it, and it just looked exactly how it was supposed to, because there was no machines, it was all tapered and stuff like that. So I had to kind of adapt Kira's look much more than I thought, because she just wouldn't have looked so great. But then when you look around, you know, to people who look great at the time, to us now, there's always a version of everything, and Jenny Sherko is definitely a person who always said that there's example of everything in the past and in every period. Not everyone looked the same. So you just have to look for examples of that. So having slightly looser hair at the time that we used in Atonement wasn't that it wasn't period, but it wasn't the typical of that period necessarily. But it was something we had to choose to make Kira look kind of at her best. And then with The Hours, it's a really good example as well, because I think it was not difficult to make Nicole look not glamorous, because she's always so glamorous the way, you know, she's done up for the red carpets and stuff and the parts that she played. But then it was Anne Roth, the costume designer, who said, oh my God, if only she had a different nose, she wouldn't be like herself. And I thought, my God, why don't we just try? So that also came from a collective kind of thought of, let's push it to the limits and see if we can do something that's so unrecognizable. And it kind of worked, although lots of people didn't like that. It's funny.
Cause oh, really?
The audience is divided, but I just thought it was brilliant that she looked so not like herself.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you've got not just for her, but when I think about other sort of big movie stars, it's really hard to separate them from the movie star that they are and the character sometimes, and all you see is the movie star. So I think that really helped her get even more into character, because you could forget that who she was with the sort of transformation of her face. I mean, you said you worked closely with costume directors. Do you work also closely with cinematographers in terms of like lighting and who else? Maybe, yeah, cameraman, like how it's going to look on camera and how, and like if the lights are too, well, maybe not anymore, but when lights are really hot, you don't want the makeup kind of sweating off of their face.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, I work very closely with lots and lots of cinematographers, and some of them are dear friends, and I work with them again and again. But one of the hardest was Barbie, funny enough, because it was so much pink everywhere, and we didn't really have that much time in prep because we pushed up by quite a few weeks for different people's availability. So Barbie was very rushed, and Rodrigo Pietro, who's one of the best, amazing human beings and amazing cinematographer, I had to ask him for a lot of help and a lot of advice, and he was always more than helpful, and without him I don't think I would have been as successful. So it's sometimes you really depend on that relationship for dear life, because there was so much correction he had to do to light those faces. I had to kind of literally just try and learn from him and take his lead and ask him for help, because I just didn't know what we were supposed to do. You know, you couldn't judge it with your eye, really. And when digital cameras came into, you know, it was when I first started, it was only film. And then suddenly digital medium came in. And at first it was very clunky and very difficult. And they would always manipulate the material afterwards. So sometimes what you were looking at on set was pretty bad. And I knew few actors who were very upset looking at their image on the monitors on set when the beginnings of digital photography. But they could do so much in the post, it kind of somehow came out okay in the end. But now I think we've settled in to it being very similar to film. It's a very similar process. And you do, yeah, but you do really need to kind of have a relationship with your DP and certainly with the camera department. I mean, the camera departments have become even more skilled these days, because with film, we used to have kind of rehearsals and you can see your makeup was kind of walking through the set as the rehearsals were happening for the camera department. Now they don't have that anymore. They just have to guess everything. So we all suffer in that way, because we have to kind of be more perfect with what we do. We have to be completely ready. But I've always learned that from working with Jenny, particularly because she always wanted to give an actor the most freedom to be able to do their job. So I was always taught that we can't sort of leave things not perfect when the actors are on set. And also then the people take photographs, like the on-set photographers take photographs. And you want everything to be perfect for that reason. So, you know, she wouldn't ever like ladies' hair in pink nets and stuff like that if you could help it. So people have more freedom to do their jobs in the best possible way, but then it puts the pressure on us that we have to be perfect and do our jobs as best as we can from first thing in the morning, rather than kind of send people on set not ready and then you can catch up later after rehearsal. You know, she wanted everyone, and I still think that that's kind of helped me today, because nothing's really changed now. We don't really get rehearsals that much, so we have to be perfect. Mentioning Barbie, I mean, that was really hard in that sense that no one's ever done a movie on a pink set like that, with everything being perfect and everything being, you know, the whole body being covered and every, you know, the perfection of the human form totally distorted into something more fake than real. But I already kind of had that training that things have to be perfect and they had to be there for the actors to be able to go to set and rehearse and or do whatever they need to do and just get going. So that training from those early days was, and that approach helped me to still kind of not feel the pressure of the new digital era.
That's interesting, because it was one of my questions actually, is like, since we're in an era where audiences are sort of hyper aware of details now, you know, whether it gets sort of reshared onto the internet or with HD, for example, on TV now, and also with like CGI or prosthetics, do you sort of feel that, like, that pressure, did you feel pressure for it to be perfect, or that it's sort of under more scrutiny than before?
What I do think it's amazing is that the audiences are more clever, and the audiences, you know, want things to be better and real. And, you know, when I sort of nowadays you look at films and you go, my god, everything is on such a high standard, how do we constantly get better and better? It's almost like, I read the other day that there's a runner who is faster than Usain Bolt, and you think, well, it's, you know, it's like that. It's like we expect everything to be better all the time. And certainly in the film industry, it's happened, because the dramas and films and all these different shows, the audiences write about it, and there's forums, and the pressure of that was huge. I think the pressure of audiences not liking Barbie was, I would have died. Said, oh my god!
I mean, there's so much. Such a big hype for it.
So I really kind of didn't want anyone to be horrible about what we were doing, because, you know, the pressure of all of that. And in fact, it's so interesting, because that also is so normalized. When we started, everything was so huge and heightened, and now I don't think it is. They all look pretty normal, because Beyonce and everyone else has big hair like that, and, you know, there's a lot of kind of popular culture kind of takes on board certain aesthetics, and then it becomes normalized. There is a good side to all of that, you know. All that big hair is not so alien in the high street at the moment, so, you know, there's that as well. But the pressure of pleasing the audiences that are much cleverer is definitely present.
So it sort of segues quite well into my next question, because you've been talking about Barbie, and it was definitely one of my favourite films of last year, and it was so hyped up, and especially just the whole media marketing campaign around it with her outfits. And yeah, and I read that you said that Margot Robbie had over 30 different costumes with makeup and hair to go with each look. And yeah, just, it must have been such a fun but fast-paced project to work on. But I'm wondering, how did you manage to keep everything so organized and maintain like consistency over all these looks? You know, if I think about just on me personally changing my lip color at the last minute, it's going to kind of ruin like it, I feel like it'll ruin all the rest of the makeup. So I'm wondering how you're, obviously you're filming different scenes and stuff, but yeah, how do you switch all the different looks and make sure it's all organized?
Well, it was kind of hard, because there was at one point Greta Gerwig, our director, said, well, maybe Barbie's always the same, maybe she just looks the same all the time, because there is a stereotypical Barbie, is the first Barbie that we all think of, with long blonde hair, that's it. And then very, very quickly, you know, Margot and Jacqueline Durand, the costume designer, were like, no, she has different hair with different, it's like an accessory. She has,
yeah, like when you buy a Barbie, you know, you have all the different types of Barbies, yeah.
And she has different earrings, and she has different hair, and she has different hair slides, and everything comes in. I was like, okay. And then I remember sitting down with Margot and Jacqueline on a couch in the costume department, and we're going through the script and going through what she would look like with different costume and what we're going to do. And it just grew and grew and grew and grew. And I was like, oh my God, that is 18 wigs now, 30 hair pieces. And it was just huge. But we didn't somehow, there was only a few days when we had like two or three different changes. Then it kind of settled down as the scenes grew longer and bigger. We were kind of filming them So they didn't have too many changes, and that would have compromised the... Too many changes, of course, compromised the quality of everything because you have to do it quickly. No one can wait for you to do that. So somehow that wasn't too bad. I mean, we had a couple of days when we were doing those montage sequences where we had like five changes in one day, and that was tough. That was really tough. But Margot is Margot is amazing. She's not only a producer, but she never moans, she never complains. She stands there, she does a job, she does all her other stuff while she's being changed so that she can catch up with her own work. So there is that. And I think actors have changed as well as the industry. And there was at one point in my career, there were movie stars and they behaved like movie stars. Nowadays, I think, I can't actually pinpoint when that happened, but most actors that I work with do their homework. But all of them, they do their homework, they come prepared, they are never late, they do their bit because they know that then it maximizes their time on camera and that gives them a chance to be better. So I don't see any movie star behavior anymore, and people are just really, really
working hard
to be working, and they want to be better than the last time, or better than, they want to give the film the best shot they can. And so we don't really have any struggles with that anymore, but we did at one point.
Makes the job easier then.
And I think that's where also, people think that it's glamorous to be in the industry and all this sort of stuff. There's nothing glamorous in it. It's just hard work. But there's a lot of rewards. And
A sprinkle of glamour afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Which makes it all worth it. Just popping in here for a quick breather. If you're anything like me, this might be the perfect moment to grab a cup of tea. Thanks so much for tuning in to The Real Girls Club and my chat with the amazing Ivana Primorac. If you're enjoying it, don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Real Girls Club, and please take a second to like, subscribe and leave a rating. It really makes a difference. All right, should we get back into the conversation? Have you noticed any sort of unique dynamics or approaches when working on projects with female directors, such as, Greta Gerwig, for example? Did you notice sort of her style of working compared to how you'd maybe worked with other directors?
Well, I worked on the film I mentioned before called A Sister, My Sister. It was a film about two sisters who committed this, it's a true story, who committed this terrible crime sometime in the 30s and maybe 20s in France. And that was the first time I've experienced the whole, most of the crew were females. A female director, Nancy Meckler, and female first, and female, all heads of departments were female. And that I remember as feeling like that's very unusual. That was unusual then, but it was definitely a different kind of dynamic. Working with Greta and other female directors and producers, and Kate Winslet, who I worked with a lot, who produced Mare of Easttown, being around her when she was producing her first project, I don't think there is any difference. And I think the difference still that I notice is them still having to fight for, when they're gathering money and financing, because it takes a long time to get a movie together. To sit in those big boardrooms and talk to mostly men who don't understand certain things is still very tough, I think. And when it comes down to us being on set, there is no difference, because by then they would have handpicked their heads of department to make sure they have people who are best for that job. So then, but I find all female leaders to be incredibly well organized. And I don't know if that's something to do with the fact that maybe if you're not at your best, you might not make it. But I've never seen a female in a very high role, being a producer or a director or a head of department, to be weak in that role. And so it makes me think that, that's what women still want to make sure that they are. And I remember being on different film sets, particularly as an assistant, where you see unprepared directors. They don't know what they want from the scene. They don't actually know what the scene is about. And I haven't been around that for a very long time, but I do distinctly remember a few of those situations, thinking, how is that possible?
Yeah.
You are here with all these people, hundreds of people, and you don't really know what you want to do. Certainly when you have people like Greta, who's so uber prepared and incredible leader and knows what she wants from her every scene, that is also coupled with the music that inspires you, and it just multi-layered, let alone organized in the way that it needs to be for the film to be completed and for us to complete our days. The days can't be longer than you know, 18, well, 12 hours, really. And that's a long day.
So has it gone longer before than 12?
Yeah.
It can.
Certainly, you know, we've done sometimes 18 hours and
wow.
stuff. But, yeah, I mean, it's very impressive to be around people like Margot Robbie, Greta Gerwig, Kate Winslet. Those are incredible women who have learned to be incredible leaders, really. And, yeah, it is impressive. But I don't really... I've never had a bad experience on a film set being a female. And I've never seen terrible, bad behaviour, luckily. I'm also glad about that.
It's another perfect segue into my next question, because you've mentioned Kate Winslet, and I was going to say that I also saw Lee this year and I loved it. And I loved also that I could see Kate Winslet's wrinkles. They weren't hidden, and it was like rarely a focus on her beauty in the film. You know, it was really about, well, her work, her character, her words, her experience and her body language as a war photographer. And I think personally it's becoming too rare now that we accept appearances like this in the media of women. You know, we, like, for example, I open up TikTok and it puts a filter on my face before I even want it to. It's like we're being pushed to have smooth faces. And I seen Kate Winslet with wrinkles. I was like, I need to see this more, because I'm 29 and I'm trying to like hide wrinkles already. And I can feel it, the pressure already starting, and girls getting Botox, you know, all this sort of stuff. So yeah, I just love that about the film. And you've also worked with Kate on so many other films, like Hannah and the Reader as well. You know, like a woman that just looks like a woman that's lived a life, you know what I mean? Not like some perfected kind of clone woman. And Kate Winslet's always been very vocal about her love for aging and embracing it, you know, in different videos I've seen online. And yeah, you've worked a lot together. Is this something you both discuss at length when you're working on a project together, about, you know, showing women as they should be, you know, without all this sort of airbrushing and perfectionism?
Yeah, well, you know, it was 2008 when I first met Kate, and it's a long time ago now, and so we have been through a lot, and I love all the different characters we've done together. We've certainly done some very interesting ones, and more. She always looks different in everything we do. And when we got to do Lee, I mean, Lee was such a huge passion project for her, because she wanted to do it for such a long time. It took 9 or 10 years, I think, for it to actually finally happen. And, you know, I love working with, you know, serious, brilliant actors who bring so much to the table. And I always look out for everything to do with the aesthetic, to do with the acting process. Like, sometimes camera can be too low and distorts your face, that it's not really recognizable. So some of the things that I will watch when I'm working with my actors is also to watch for those kind of things that represent them in the best way. So if the camera's too low and it's a really kind of not a great shot, it's not necessarily just about the vanity, but it's about the distortion of the image.
Right.
And so I've learned to kind of look out for everything to do with that character. And I would mention it to Kate if I saw something that wasn't great. And I actually heard an interview with her on 60 Minutes that she did about Lee, and she talked about how a member of the crew said to her that she was sitting down in a bad way and that she had so few rolls sticking out. That was me, and she didn't say it was me. And I did say that to her. I said, by the way, this angle is not great. And she said, you know what? Lee would not care. Lee would want to be free, completely free. And that's what I'm going to do. And that's what she did. And I was partly, you know, I'm always going to look out for the actors and their best well-being.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
You know, it's a craft. But it was so incredibly refreshing that she said that and played the scene in the most amazing, beautiful way. And it was a great scene. And then when she told that on this interview, it wasn't kind of in a bad way. She just said, you know, those kind of things happen to us women. And she said, I wanted to just be, and I wanted to just, you know, feel free, and Lee would want to be that. And I thought, God, that was me.
I mean, it was your natural instinct, though, as a makeup artist, you know, like to have something look its best, to have someone look their best.
And pass it by her, and it will always be her choice. And I will always look out for my actors and people I work with. But it is something that's, you know, it is an amazing and liberating thing for her as an actor to have had that choice and to say, no, Lee would have chosen to be free and to be like this and to be, you know, with all her wrinkles and bits showing.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter what I look like. It's how I am in this role.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really liberating. And I think, yeah, and the message is, it's you know, I'm just so lucky to have been working with some serious character actors.
Mm.
They've taught me, and I've kind of moved through the years working with the same people who just get better.
Mm.
And I do think that will also help. You know, and we did talk about this, you know, when you are on the red carpet and you look absolutely amazing, and then people see you on the big screen and you look real, it's actually so much better than, because you are allowed to look amazing on the red carpet, and we can all look great, but it's great for people to see that. Even I watched that television series Perfect Couple with Eve Hewson, who just looks so real. She's young, she's in her late 20s or early 30s. There she was as well, with very little makeup, and I noticed how natural. She's incredible. She was in Noah Baumbach's movie that I just completed earlier this year. And she is one of those actresses who I just think is going to go very far with her attitude towards her work. It's not about what she looks like. Obviously, she wants to look right. But she gets immersed into the role to the point that it doesn't matter. They can see her little wrinkles already and her little imperfections. I was like, that's incredible.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, once they're in a role, it's not about the movie star looking good. Yeah. It's about the character they're playing, ultimately. Also, more recently, I haven't actually had the chance to see it yet, but in We Live in Time, you worked on a character dealing with cancer with Florence Pugh. And I'm wondering how you approach creating makeup that reflects sort of the physical and emotional toll of going through that, but also maintaining like the dignity of the character. And Florence, because I heard actually, I think she voluntarily shaved all her hair off for that role.
Yeah, she did. Well, Florence is, a remarkable young actor who is going to take all the right choices for the role. She's a young warrior, really. Mm. So she decided that she wanted to shave her hair on camera, because there's a scene where she knows she's going to have to go through chemotherapy, so she wanted to do it with her daughter and her husband together. So it's kind of acknowledging that they're going to go through this terrible experience together. So she wanted to do that for the film and for John Crowley, who's our director. So we knew that that's something that we're going to have to do and do for real. So when we were setting the character of this young woman who we see way before she meets her husband when she was younger, and then the story is told in a kind of a jumbled up way, and we always knew that there was going to be this moment where she's going to shave her hair off, and then we then had to do her hair with a wig, but we couldn't have it cut in with the real hair, so it shows it's a wig. So that was technically quite difficult and a challenge. So that film, I'm very proud of that film, because I think that was another challenge, is just to tell the story seamlessly, and when people watch it, they will never know there was very much in it, because there's just this young girl with her blonde hair with her different length fringe that, you know, we did to kind of tell the different times in her life, and then she shaves her hair off, and then the story goes on. So to do that seamlessly so that no one sees what we actually have to do was the challenge of that film, and that's, you know, one of my favorites, because you're not supposed to see what we do. We're supposed to be completely invisible.
Yeah, and it's like about creating an illusion. Sort of,
and that's another thing that, you know, I always talk about, because these days the awards are very, very important to people, and every year every film gets, you know, put up for different awards, and you have to quite often talk about what we did to be kind of hopefully nominated for different awards. And I sort of more and more think now is that we're not, you know, I just don't want people to know. My biggest pride and joy is when people review films that I worked on and never mention anything to do with makeup and hair, which means that they completely believe it.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to know that these people didn't have long or short or blonde or dark hair. It's supposed to be seamless. And if I've done my job well, no one will ever mention it.
Mm.
And that is kind of what I really want to go for these days.
Mm.
It's just completely fool the viewer and the public that these are the people that they're watching in that situation, rather than talk about how wonderful I am at, you know, doing my job.
Mm.
And We Live in Time definitely was that opportunity for me, because of Florence desperately wanted to do it for real. And it wouldn't have been as good if she didn't do it for real. So then I had to do it, take her back to her long hair in a fake way, and trying to do it the way that no one would know that we shot, not in sequence.
It's interesting that you say that, because I've also heard cinematographers say that as well, is that they don't want people to talk about their cinematography because that means they can see it. So, you know, it's much better when they don't say anything, because that means they've sort of immersed themselves in the universe. I read somewhere that you said that you can't become a makeup artist overnight. Does every new job now for you feel like a learning curve, or do you feel that from all your wealth of experience that now it just feels second nature? It's like you just go into set and you're like, you know what you're doing, or is it always still a bit of a new challenge, a new learning curve?
It's always a new challenge and always a learning curve, and I'm always petrified, and my boyfriend always says, you always say that, and I go, no, I don't. This time I'm really scared, and this time I'm really don't know if I'm going to pull it off. And he goes, no, you always say that. And so I had to listen to that, because that is how I feel. And I think my experience has just given me more fear in lots of ways, because I think, well, maybe this time I won't pull it off, you know? And but in a good way, because I care so much about what I do and I love so much what I do, is maybe that pushes me to work harder. And that is the only thing I would say that I still do, and I work as hard as ever, if not more, and I prepare more, and you know, I put more pressure on myself to try and do it better. And I think it's that keeps me going. And I certainly don't ever want to retire, because I think my best work is yet to come.
Yeah, you want to be like that woman that you mentioned, till 93, still working on films. That's funny that you say that, because before every podcast interview I do or anything, I'm like, oh, I'll be fine now, because I've done it a few times now, but I'm still nervous every time. Because it's a new person, a new experience, and as you say, you don't know how it's going to go, but I think that's good. It means you don't become complacent, or, you know, and it keeps you on your toes and everything, so... What would you say requires the most amount of time to do in makeup and hair, and like the least amount? I was speaking with a previous podcast guest, and she was telling me about things in animation that took a really long time to do and what doesn't take a long time to do. So I'm wondering, yeah, what's like done super quick and what takes hours?
I think prosthetics definitely takes more hours because of the process. I mean, prosthetics has changed so much in the last 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we had foam. And now we've got silicones, which are encapsulated, so they're liquid inside, so it behaves like skin. So the prosthetic makeups take a long time, but then once they're on, they're kind of on in the most natural sort of way. You don't really have that much to kind of upkeep, as it were. Mm-hmm. So prosthetics still does. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, I just did a movie in Iceland a month ago, and I had to recreate Ronald Reagan and Michael Gorbachev. And... you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, we would have had a ball cap that's vinyl. And, you know, we all know how to do that. Some people better than others. But now with this silicone ball cap, it becomes, his head becomes completely bald. And they punch in the hair. And it's kind of amazing. But that takes an hour and a half to put on, or an hour to put on. And you can't really, those processes have to be, you can't really, once it's down, it's down. You know, it has to be in the right place because it's built to be on that person's head. So I would say prosthetics is still the most time consuming. Wigs are difficult because you have to do all the work that you need to do on the wig for it to look natural happens without the actor there. If you don't do all that prep, it's never going to be right on the head. So I wash every wig I ever use every day. I make it look amazing every day. Every hair should be in the right place, so it mimics the hairline of the person that you're putting it on. I never not do that work. And that means that sometimes I have to do lots of overtime, or on a film that still doesn't have very much money, I have to do it for free. I just have to do it.
So your bathroom's just filled with lots of wigs everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, I have to stay at work later and do it there, or you just have to do all that work because otherwise it's not going to be great. So that is the hard thing, because you can't sort of go, oh, it'll be all right tomorrow. It will never be all right tomorrow. You have to do the groundwork every day, and so that prep work that happens before the actor then makes the process with the actor quicker, because sometimes by the time you curled someone's hair or prepared someone's hair, it can take longer. You know, those shampoo and sets that women had in the 40s and the 50s would take an hour and a half in the hairdressers every time. So a wig can be prepared before they arrive, and then it's on their heads, quicker. So that's kind of a trade-off, I think. Sometimes you can speed up the process with the actor by preparing before.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as I said before, I've learned and I'm still obsessed with trying to change someone's face with light and shade and the old techniques of just three different pencils that, you know, Dick Smith used to create that incredible makeup Gandhi, you know, that was so simple. And that was, that kind of artistry is still unmatched. And, you know, to be able to do those kind of makeups, I'm still learning and pushing and trying to learn. And if you can see how you can change someone's face with different, changing their shape and changing the face shape and the balance of the face and the to go with the costume and the collar and the hair length and all of those sort of things come together to change someone completely.
Mm. Do you have, sorry, go on if you haven't finished.
No, but you can be quick with that. Once you get your head around it, that can be quicker than a beauty makeup where you have to paint on someone's. I'm obsessed with watching, you know, Beyonce's makeup artist do her makeup, because that's something that's a different world. They paint that face on. I mean, it's kind of incredible to watch, and I'm obsessed with that as much as I'm obsessed with character makeups, because you know, you can do that quite quickly if you know what you're going for.
Is there like maybe a couple of key products that every makeup artist starting out in the industry should have in their kit that you work with maybe all the time, like it's something you have to use every day?
You know, when I first started, there were very few makeups that were good for film. So it was Viseura, that was one brand, it was made by Dior, and it was a specifically made makeup for film and television. Now, there's so many incredible brands that we can use for film and television that, you know, it's much easier. And I do think that I remember some older makeup artists when I first started who could make a beautiful foundation out of those very thick theatrical Kryolan sticks that everyone used, because that's all we had. So it's how you manipulated those makeups, and if you can make that look good, that was a kind of enormous skill set there. Now we have such amazing makeups to work with that that process is easier. And also, you know, we've got amazing tanning products. You know, you can make someone look tanned very easily without it being orange or thick, or, you know, the sort of kind of, I don't even know how they do it. It's kind of almost they change color to suit that person in their skin. I mean, it's very scientific makeup these days.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that learning how to do a character makeup with a red pencil, a taupe pencil for shading, and the red pencil for, or, you know, pink pencil for anything to do with blush and blood in your skin, and a highlighter and something to make shadow with, like a shader and a highlighter, is the base of every makeup. And that's the glamour or character. Everyone, you know, uses those techniques really to create those glamorous or real faces. So there are still some, you know, there's a good old Kryolan makeup palette that I learned, which was meant for ball caps, that I learned to use with Jenny all those years ago, and I still have on every film. I use the same palette because it's very high pigmented, and you can use it for, you know, painting faces and wounds and character things, and you can paint hair with it. So I still have the same old Kryolan double grease makeup palette on every job.
So have you noticed also a change in like sustainability on set? Obviously it's a lot of makeup, and how does the production team make sure it's like, no, I can't find the word, but anyway, hopefully you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's another incredible thing, because, you know, now there's so many great brands that popped up because people will buy them. They have to be good. They have to do what they say on the tin. And there's a lot of them, like Lisa Eldridge or Gucci Westman, you know, amazing makeup artists who actually made those makeup brands based on their experiences within the industry, and they know what they want their clients to look like. So, you know, Gucci Westman worked with Gwyneth Paltrow, who's always fresh. Lisa Eldridge, who I idolize in every way, is made her brand based on what she wants her makeup that she uses on her favorite clients and her people that she works with look amazing on the red carpet. And she's so clever with formulas, and she knows all about formulas, that she actually is, it made her brand do what she wants it to do. And I use a lot of her brand on film now, because it's just amazing, and it does, you know, does do a great job. So technically there's a lot to work with now. They're all different kind of things that you can work with that actually do a better job than something that you work with, you know, certainly like eyebrows. We all need to change our eyebrows, but we can't pluck them as much anymore.
Mm.
So there's so many eyebrow products that some of them really do work amazing. So yeah, there's a lot of new formulations, and I mean, people just won't buy it if it doesn't work. So there's a lot of research going into makeup and beauty industry. And I work very closely now, which I didn't before, with people who do facials amazingly on a very high level, because certainly on Barbie, we needed everyone to have flawless, beautiful skin, pumped by, you know, the products and, you know, all the different, we had balls in the fridge and all sorts of things that we were massaging faces in the morning, and it made so much difference. So makeup is getting more scientific in that way, because you can't just pile on more and more, it will show. So you kind of need to strip it back.
Yeah.
Which also goes well with aging skins. You know, if you put a lot of makeup on an aging skin, which is anything above 35, it will show, it will settle in your wrinkles.
Yeah.
And that's kind of not cool, because then people, you know, we've been through all of that. That's why we've been through Botox and all that sort of stuff that people started doing, because they felt they had to.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're coming through that now, and people realize that with great makeup and cinematography, we've gone back to lighting the face is better again, and people don't need to kind of do all those things that maybe they felt they had to at one point, you know, in sort of end of the 90s and beginning of 2000s. We were a bit clunky with all of that, and digital photography came in, people didn't look so great. So I feel like the women are more prepared to be themselves, because they know there's products out there that can make them look great the age they are.
There's so much choice on the market now. Sometimes I don't even, when I go into Boots or Superdrug or any, or Sephora, I'm like, I don't even know where to start.
No.
But yeah, there's a lot of choice now. But obviously some brands that are better than others and more sustainable and things like that. And I definitely, like, as you're talking about the eyebrow sort of thing, like, that was definitely like a big trend maybe when I was, I don't know, even still now, but it was like, I suppose maybe in my earlier 20s where it was all about the brows. But I think now it is all about the skin, where we just want good skin that looks young as possible, as clear as possible, and you know, kind of that kind of what do they call it, like the well, not the natural look, but they call it something else in the makeup industry, but where it's like, it's almost like there's no makeup, and that's the kind of look that people are going for, is they're wearing it but it's supposed to look like they're not.
But I wanted to just add, I forgot to say about sustainability, so the brands now are more sustainable. There was one point where a lot of people wanted to go kind of vegan and sustainable, but it was almost impossible. Where now there's some great sustainable brands, and they actually are better than some brands which are kind of a more chemically based.
Mm.
And also people used to buy technology from people who tested on animals.
Mm.
So then you were stuck again. So what do you do? So they said they don't test on animals, but they buy the technology from people who do. That's kind of evened out now. And there are a lot of actors and a lot of people do care for more sustainable products and more natural products, meaning they don't have too many parabens and too many bad chemicals in them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier with that. Again, it's easier to find brands which actually do all those things.
Just got a couple more questions and then I will let you go. Just more about sort of you and your future projects. Is there anything you haven't done yet? I mean, you said, you don't want to retire, and, you know, why should you? I mean, you love what you do. And
I've never done anything in the 20s, and like a whole piece that would depict that period in its full kind of how, that's a very difficult period because all the silhouettes and everything is very, very different from anything we can relate to. And there might be a chance for me to do that with Kate Winslet, funny enough. She has a very exciting project based in the 20s. And so if that really materialized, I would be petrified but thrilled. And then, yes, you know, the Greta Gerwig always has an amazing projects ahead.
I've seen she's working on Narnia now.
And I'm going to do that with her. So that's kind of daunting at the moment. So that feels like, how are we going to do that?
Is it the whole series?
No, she's going to kick off with the first book. So she's going to do the first book, which is The Magician's Nephew. And that one's never been done before. And it's brilliant. So, yeah, so we're going to do that. So it feels like, and then there's a couple of other projects that I have had mentioned that I was like, oh my God, I would love to do that because I've never done that. So it feels like there's so many stories out there, and it feels like the directors and the producers are coming up with some amazing ideas. It feels like the industry's kind of getting very exciting again, and I just want to do it all. I'm going to fit it all in.
Yeah, I know, you need more time. I'm assuming you're at a point in your career now where you're not going after the jobs, or it's not your agent, you've got the contacts now and they come to you.
They do, but you know, still sometimes I was put out for a couple of films I didn't get, and I was like, oh, this is so gutting. But you know, that's what keeps you going, and that's what keeps you excited. But also interesting is, you know, it's scary business employing people for the producers, and you know, and some of the big Marvel films, for example, I've never done. I don't think I would know how to necessarily do those kind of characters. I've never done the Bond. There's so many kind of skill sets that you need for those kind of films that, you know, if it was the right director and the right time, of course I would want to. But yeah, partly I do get people coming back to me now because they know me and my work, but mm-hmm. There's also so many genres and people that I don't necessarily am not right for and I haven't done. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it's also the great part of the industry. People kind of do go through it in based on their interests and what they're best at.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. You have to sort of see the, maybe not rejection, but yeah, like that not getting something is a redirection. It's not meant for yes. you and your sort of your
exactly.
style and skill set.
Yeah.
And probably yeah. also because those people are going with the people they regularly work with as well. So yeah, kind of they stay in their, maybe not cliques, like hopefully it's not a cliquey sort of industry, but yeah, maybe it's not cliquey, yeah. but in a way it's kind of, they've got their kind of troops and groups of people. Yeah. I don't know. What kind of advice would you give to someone wanting to go into the industry like yourself? If you could tell your younger self anything, you know, when she was starting out.
But I also have to mention that there's so many younger makeup designers coming through now who are very, very impressive, and sometimes I'm a little bit jealous inverted commas, like, oh, I want to do that. Well, no, everyone has to get their right job, and that we all, and there are amazing makeup designers out there who I, some of them know personally and, you know, love their work. And it's exciting to see that. That's part of natural part of aging. And, you know, I was that when I was working with Jenny Shirko. And now I see the same me coming behind me in the form of different brilliant people. Mm. So I would say, with all the fear and uncertainty that I've been through, if you really, really want to do this job, you'll end up doing it. And that I can guarantee, if anyone really 100% wants to do something, they'll succeed. And I didn't know that then, and if my younger self had someone to tell her that, it would have been comforting. Because the fear of not being able to do something, I think, is crippling at times. And I think if you just know that if you want to do something, you'll end up doing it. That's it, because you'll find the way and you'll learn. It'll be you who, you know, I remember getting advice from people, you know, when I was at makeup school, you need to have a business card, you need to do this. I didn't do any of those things. I was just like, how am I going to ever hand someone a business card? If they really want my number, they'll write it down and they'll keep it.
Yeah.
And I never had a business card and I never needed one. You know, there's so many things that people say, you have to do this, you have to, and you can do everything your way. Definitely there's not one way of doing it, but you just have to really want to do what you want to do and you'll definitely succeed.
That's great advice.
But it takes a long time, and
yeah,
you know, it's taken a very long time for me to become a designer, and I've never regretted any of that time that I was an assistant, and it's still taking a long time to kind of learn and be better as a designer, and that's also brilliant, because I think we're all in it for a long haul. There's no quick anything. You just have to, if you do what you love to do, you'll enjoy it.
Definitely. Great advice. And as you were saying, you know, there are people, obviously, you know, younger makeup artists coming up after you. And but yeah, I guess it's, everyone's got their own timeline, and, you know, everyone, you know, you can pass on your knowledge to them. And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of makeup artists now, even more than ever, I think, with, you know, after the sort of boom of YouTube and tutorials.
Yeah.
And now with the TV series called Glow Up, I think it is. I don't know if you watch it.
Yes.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Which is,
you know, one of my trainees, one of them was the runner up in the second Glow Up. And when we were working together on a film called Rebecca, he was practicing all the makeups and everything, going for his auditions and everything. And I'm so very proud of him for, you know, that he then took that route, and he's very famous in the fashion world. So it is amazing. And we all push each other with the quality And what's brilliant about the film industry and the beauty industry and all of these different interesting things that, you know, and podcasts and people talking about what we do is, you know, it keeps us all, it's ageless. It's an ageless kind of process. We can work next to someone who is 18 or 19 or 80 or 93. It doesn't matter. We can all kind of share the space together and do things together. And I think that's what I like, rather than maybe in banking, it's not like that. You know, maybe there is a kind of a
hierarchy.
Age group.
Yeah.
Hierarchy. Exactly. And the film industry is brilliant for that. Because you end up working, it doesn't matter how old you are, you know, if you're still into it and really want to get up at 3 a.m. and go in the middle of nowhere somewhere to tell the story, you could do it.
Yeah, exactly. You can sort of, learn from basically anyone of any age. And there's no kind of, I mean, maybe not the same kind of barriers in the same way like there might be in other industries. Also, just, definitely. I think it's amazing now that there's not just that one way to get into it. I don't think you'd have to necessarily do a traineeship or go to a makeup school, like things like Glow Up. Like, yeah, you can start uploading YouTube videos. There is more ways now, I think, to start off, which is great.
And it's brilliant. And you can't, you know, and people before, I think, were less open-minded. I think now open-minded people will survive and thrive, which is a good side of all of this and the technology and the TikToks and the phones, all of that. You know, you can make a movie on your iPhone and people will see it.
Yeah, exactly. Good,
you know, so
I mean, you've mentioned a little bit about what you're working on, but what's immediately next for you coming up next year? Any projects that are coming out that you'd like to share and talk about?
I'm going to do a very exciting project with Kate Winslet in January, and then I'm going to do Narnia. So,
wow, busy year then. Yeah. It's not the 20s one, that's a different one.
It's a different one.
Okay.
It's a different one.
She's got so many, I mean, she's another person that's clearly not stopping. She's just like... She loves what she does and
exactly.
Really passionate about the film she does and the project she's on.
Yeah, and I'm thrilled that I could do that one with her, so it's great. So
it keeps your diary January. It keeps your diary filled as well.
Exactly.
And lastly, how do you sort of stay grounded and inspired in an industry where it's, you know, very fast paced and you say, you know, sometimes long hours when you're not on films, which is obviously maybe like 99% of your life, or like what's the other, you know, 1%, you know, what are you doing to sort of stay zen?
I think one day maybe, you know, this strike and COVID has really messed up a lot of our lives. You know, it's so funny how I think I can see effects of COVID only now, really.
A lot of still today.
Yeah. You know, in lots of ways, kind of stoppage of work and how everyone's been affected by it is still visible. And then we had the strike. So we've had a bit of a rough time in the film industry. But, you know, hopefully as life goes on, you know, with all this incredible work that's out there with streamings and, you know, there's definitely more work now than when I first started, which means that there's so many more people who can pick and choose what to do. But you can also prioritize life. And, you know, I like to travel a lot and have a partner who likes to travel a lot. I like to go to as many art exhibitions and theatre and all sorts of things like that. And I like to be at home. So I'm never bored and it's never boring. And it's all about the team that you have. I had an amazing team at the moment of people who I can call back. And, you know, it takes a long time to build a team. And then sometimes you come out of sync. But at the moment, in sync with some amazing people that I work with a lot, and that makes everything easier. And my passion is also making the industry better for them, because a lot of my assistants are now young mums, and you know, there's more children now. You know, when I first started, people were like, no, you shouldn't really have kids because, you know, you can't cope with being a mum within this industry because no one will tolerate you. The hours are impossible. Now it's possible. And I really do try and let my young mums have a life and maybe do part-time at home. You know, people can, if I can, I send them home to put their kids to bed and they can work afterwards from home, or maybe take a shorter day in a week, depending on how old the kids are and what their needs are. And that's been incredibly successful. I've never really had anyone let me down. And I think I've proven that if we're organized and loyal to each other, we can actually do that. So that's been my passion, to try and improve life for my younger generations of people who work with me, because it is a bit rough at times. You know, it is tough. You know, on Barbie, sometimes I slept 4 hours a night, but I always knew when the end was.
Yeah.
You know, I knew if we just get through this. But when you are a young mum and your kids are going through a difficult patch, or it's less of an illness, really. You know, when they get a cold, it's fine. You know, you go home. But it's sometimes kids need you more than other times. And then suddenly young mums find it difficult to cope with all of that. And you just have to go home. You have to be with them. And they'll be okay in 2 or 3 days. You know, and we can do that. And all of my young mums and assistants now, you know, every year they're older, and every year there's less of what's happened before, or there's something new. And then suddenly they're 16, 17, 18, and off they go.
They just have to get through this sort of rough patch. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now with so many women in the industry, I guess, like even just the people you've been talking about, like Margot Robbie's, I think, I don't know if she's given birth yet, but yeah, she's pregnant, and Greta Gerwig's a mum, Kate Winslet's a mum. All the people you've worked with are mums.
Yeah, and Kate, when I first met her, was we had to wait for her to become available for this film that we wanted her to do, because she had to wait for the Easter holidays.
Uh-huh.
She was primarily a mum, and then she would act in the holidays, so when the kids could be with her. I was like, this woman, she cooks every meal. They call her and go, "Mum, where's my socks?" And she'll tell them where they are. She's a super mum. Now she's with the youngest one. She's got she also prioritizes them, but she also has an amazing husband who's there with the youngest one. So things are easier for her now. But with the first two kids, she was a mum. And then she would be an actress. That's, you know, it is possible, and I think it's
possible. Great though that the industry is making it that way, because I'm sure it's not always been like that.
And also for camera department, it's harder. You know, as a focus puller, you can't just leave.
No.
As a makeup designer, as a makeup artist, you can arrange it better. In the costume department, in the prop department, in many departments, you can.
Well, we've had to adapt with COVID how to work from home. So I think it's like we have kind of learnt how to make certain jobs work from home.
Yeah,
when previously they weren't.
Which is amazing, yeah.
Okay, very last question. Can you tell me, say, 5 films that you love for their makeup?
So I would say it has to be Amadeus, has to be Gandhi, has to be Carlito's Way, which I saw the other day that I haven't watched for many, many years. That's incredible for makeup. Has to be All Quiet on the Western Front, which came out last year, which was extraordinary.
On Netflix, the German film.
Yeah, German film. Extraordinary. What else?
I think that's Amadeus, Gandhi, Carlito's Way.
All Quiet on the Western Front. So that's 5.
Was that 5? Hold on, Carlito's Way, Amadeus, Gandhi, All Quiet on the Western Front. There's
one more,
I think. But yeah, it could be 4 or 5. It's not a big deal.
What else can I think of that I liked for makeup?
I've only seen 1 out of 4 so far. I've seen Gandhi, which was in my religious studies education at school years ago.
And I'll tell you what else I like, Godfather movies. They're amazing for makeup. They're incredible.
Definitely.
Yeah, so that's my 5.
Okay, great. Got them all. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Ivana.
It was lovely to talk to you. If you ever need anything, you know where to find me.
Oh, thank you. That's lovely. And it's been one of the nicest chats I've had from a podcast. Thank you so much, Ivana. It was lovely speaking to you. Have a lovely evening. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Real Girls Club with Ivana Primorac. I just love this conversation with her, and I honestly could have spoke to her for hours. If you enjoyed our conversation, don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Real Girls Club, and you can also like and subscribe to this podcast and leave a rating. It really helps us grow and reach more film lovers, so thank you so much. This is the last podcast episode of 2024, and I can't wait to come back next year in 2025 with more exciting and interesting guests for the podcast. I really appreciate every one of you who listened to this podcast, and I hope you have a lovely Christmas and a happy new year, and I'll see you in 2025.